Hello and welcome, everyone. It is hard to believe that MTG Potpourri is bringing you another podcast within less than a month.
And I actually don't believe it.
I haven't checked the date, so I might be lying on that one.
Is this actually MTG Potpourri? Is this the A-Team? We're all just guest hosting the A-Team and nobody else showed up? Is that what happened?
Yeah,
that is 100% correct.
It's more likely.
Yeah, I guess I have never... I'm showing my ignorance. I have not yet listened to the A-Team. I know it's a very popular Magic podcast.
It's been around like 6 years.
What's that?
And it's been around like 3 years. You haven't listened to it a single time in 3 years?
I didn't listen to Monday Night Magic for about 6 years, and I was on it for roughly 6.5 years. So if that tells you kind of how it goes.
Pop quiz. What episode number are we up to?
Three.
35, maybe?
There's a three involved. So we're episode three for Conley. 35 for...
I'm actually going with 39.
Yeah, that's too high. I swear it's like maybe 33 or 35. I think it's
33? So there's two...
This is episode...
There were two threes involved.
Three.
See, I was right. I only gave half the answer, and Tom's supposed to say the other half, so I got my three right. Screw you, Tom.
You gotta read between the lines.
Together, Conley and I are one man.
Yeah.
So who are we? So Tom, introduce yourself to everyone at home.
Yeah, we'll actually do introductions since we're starting to do this on a more regular, I guess, schedule again. I am Tom. I am the de facto host of MTG Potpourri, a podcast that's about anything besides Magic for 85% of the podcast.
65.
Yeah, 65%. The rest of it is usually talking about organisms going to other orifices where they shouldn't go.
Tom brings that element to the show. Me and Adam stay away from that area.
Yeah. But you might want to be all up in that area.
I'm just adding a caveat by the rest of it means the rest of the words that come out of Tom's mouth.
You haven't seen the Artful Shaving. It looks three-dimensional. You can have faux hawks other places than just on your head.
Oh, I know.
Did you guys, I think I may have taught this on the old Monday Night Magic, is have you guys ever done like experiments on yourself? Like, I kind of feel myself as being a scientist. Have you ever experimented on yourself? Like, one time I was curious to see if deodorant was more effective if
we
you...
We didn't make it very far, Adam, before we start talking about self-mutilation or whatever. Yeah.
So I'm Adam Staworski.
All right. I didn't even get introduced. That's how quick...
Yeah. We'll get back to you, Tom. I'm Adam Staworski. Okay. I do a bunch of magical stuff. A lot of Commander.
I'll get myself ready.
Yeah. And the other fine gentleman on the call who is absolutely in the expert seat for Magic, Conley Woods.
Sure, try to be. Yeah. What are you doing?
Do you know what the abbreviation
DRE?
DRE stand for? Do you know what that stands for?
DRE
in a medical exam context.
Direct retinal exam.
Pretty close. It's digital rectal exam.
Oh, it's close. Wait, so what? Why are you? I don't know, just mentioning it
for those people watching the video.
Yeah, a little fix. So, Tom, I did experiment on myself. I don't know if this counts as experimenting on myself because, like, I'm not a mad scientist kind. But what I did was I used, like, a little book. So I was a mathematics major. So I used a book to track how many drinks I could drink per hour till I basically was, like, kind of in that really sweet spot. And then I figured out how many drinks I needed to keep drinking after that per hour.
Were you, like, checking, like, blood alcohol levels? Or, like, how what you...
Yeah,
Without actually measuring it, no.
Yeah, it wasn't BAC, okay. But it was more like just like that feeling, like just kind of like timing it out because I
knew. Oh, guys, I'm doing awesome.
Well, no, but it's like it's like the amount of time, right? Because I know everybody processes alcohol at a slightly different rate, but like you can make kind of generalized estimates. Like, well, some people process like a drink per hour. Like
also,
that's typically kind of like an estimate.
So
what I did is I figured out what is my drink rate based on like, you know, how many does it take me to get drunk per hour, and then how long does it take me to come back down? That creates a ratio, like over time, like how fast am I processing that out? And then I just backed into like basically like if I drink a beer every 45 minutes, I stay like pretty tipsy, and it's great.
And you clearly have a problem, you know that too. But a beer every 45 minutes—that's kind of insanity.
Not when you're partying. No, what are you talking about?
He's talking about like doing his homework. That's something you do every day.
No. It's when I go out. I would
doing homework for that day when you went out to party.
Well, you're talking about your math book, so I figured this was for you studying. Like you were finding your ultimate buzz quotient.
No, but I would get drunk for some problem sets. It was really funny. I could do some.
Well, that actually works. That's state dependent learning, which is you actually remember things in the state that you learn them better. So even if you learn something drunk, you're more likely to remember that thing in that context while drunk again than you are sober.
Oh man. So if you start using peyote early,
it's not just drugs either. It's like if you're stressed out, you will actually like let's say you lose your keys while you're stressed out. It might take you getting stressed out again to find your keys.
It's like the chewing gum theory. Like, hey, if I chew one type of gum in a specific class, when I chew that gum again, I'm going to have better recollection for that information. So like they say, like if you're studying for a test, chew spearmint when you go to take that final. Chew spearmint during that final. That kind of associative.
So should I chew different flavors of gum for, like, say, different classes?
Well, yeah. Basically, the theory there is that you're triggering olfactory senses and taste buds. So your mind is associating the problems and the information you're learning with that smell and with that taste. So if you, like, let's say you did this for an entire semester, like let's say it was one test at the end of the semester, and you chewed that particular gum every single time you went to that class and no other time, eventually it'd be just like Pavlov's dogs, where you would effectively like associate that thing with that smell and that taste, and so you would trigger the memories and the information easier. You're not obviously going to like have a photographic memory or something.
Well, I'll give you that. When I studied for like my medical boards, it was kind of when audio CDs, like books on CD were coming out, so I actually listened to the Harry Potter books on CD. Just kind of over and over again as I studied. And I guess it was a state-based learning at that point.
Sure. All right. Can we talk about magic? Is there anything
about the 65% magic?
I haven't talked about my experiment yet.
Oh,
I can save it for later.
I haven't seen your gloves in a while. I thought we were done with that.
Let's save it.
No.
Let's save it. We've got a battle on our hands, don't we?
Is it a battle for baloney? No?
That would be a cool set, actually. It's a battle for things with lots of tentacles on their. I am assuming their faces. It could be the other end.
No, there are no tentacles.
I'm just excited because there's tentacles everywhere.
There's no tentacles in this set. There's no Emrakuls, only Ulamogs. Emrakul is the tentacle one, true or false?
I'm looking at the art on some of the preview cards. I would say they have things that look tentacle-like.
Maybe, but all I'm saying is Emrakul and Kozilek are not making any appearances, and their brood is not making any appearances in this particular set. It is Ulamog-based set, and Ulamog does not have any tentacles.
Okay, well, some of his kids apparently have been dipping the other side of the pool. Maybe Ulamog and stuff, maybe, you know, Mrs. Ulamog has been, you know, messing around a little bit.
Well, maybe it's just Emrakul is Mrs. Ulamog.
Oh, yeah. Here's me I'm being human. I'm being racist against Eldrazi. I assume they were, you know, male, female. They could have like 16 genders for all I know.
They could all just have one gender and they just have kids out of themselves.
Yep, they have cloacas. So they have their urogenital pores, and that's what he's saying.
I'm glad we were able to fit that highly relevant medical term in.
I try to use the word cloaca every day.
I'm well aware.
Obviously, we're talking about Battle for Zendikar at this point. For anyone who missed out or is joining us a year down the road, we're talking about Battle for Zendikar. We're in the middle of spoiler season. It's awesome.
Except
it's not awesome for Tom because there's no oozes in the set.
I have to admit, even though there's no oozes in Imps so far, I do like the kind of the plethora of the various types of Eldrazi we're seeing. Having cheap, easy to cast Eldrazi, that was a cat, that to me seems pretty exciting. And the idea that we'll talk about, like, you know, exiled cards and you get benefits by sticking them back in the graveyard. I guess I would like to know if you guys can explain kind of what the flavor basis of that is.
All right, can I go off? Am I allowed to go off for a second?
This is where you can go off.
All right. Flavor wise, I'll break that because that's pretty simple. I actually don't know, but I guess they harvest things and then you can use those things later on for very specific Eldrazi purposes. So like their harvesting is being exiled. And then later on, the ones that aren't harvesting, like the drones are the ones that harvest or whatever, and then other guys come and they take that material and they do something cool with it. So that's kind of what the story is, I guess. That's what I would go with anyway. But what I don't like is that basically no harvester and the drones that put the stuff there, like those abilities never appear together. So all the things that have ingest never do anything with the cards they're exiling, and all the guys that do something with cards that are being exiled have no way to actually exile cards. So
I'm assuming it's from a balance standpoint because some of the abilities are pretty strong.
Yes, you wouldn't have to necessarily put it on every card, but like the fact that a lot of these guys just have that ingest, like exile the top card of your opponent's deck and then don't do anything with the cards, like yes, you're getting a payoff because you're milling them, but you're doing it at such a slow rate that it's basically not realistic. So the only way these cards make sense is in context of the other cards, which is kind of cool from a meta standpoint, but it also makes like looking at any individual card or trying to parse the set as a whole very difficult because you don't have a lot of standalone pieces for limited. You have this like kind of puzzle that you have to really put together and figure out like, well, yes, the like everyone remembers Shriekmaw, very extremely powerful card, but also very uncommon. I don't think anyone would necessarily argue to put Shriekmaw at rare. It was the probably strongest uncommon in that set, but it was an uncommon. In this set, we have a 3-mana for 2 colors and a black for a 3/2 devoid creature, so it's colorless even though it's black. And when it enters the play, you may exile you may take a card from exile, put it into its opponent's graveyard, and then you give something -3/-3. So that would be what I would call the Necrotal of the set. Like, pretty standard, like, good, but it needs...
It's almost more like a Flame Tongue Kavu to me. Cause
yeah, yeah, same thing. Necrotal, Flame Tongue Kavu, whatever. But that is a rare in this set, which blew my mind. I was like, what? Like, this card doesn't even actually
it's
work.
A rare, that one's a rare?
It's a rare, yes.
Oh, I thought it was an uncommon. I guess I didn't pay attention. I figured it was an uncommon.
Exactly. It just looked like a rare to me, because like it looked like an uncommon to me, because it like, doesn't even necessarily work with itself. Like, it doesn't have a way to get cards into exile. So you have to, like, really... If you just looked at that card, you'd be like, wait, what the hell is going on? This is a rare in the set. A 3-mana, 3/2, that doesn't do anything unless something else has happened, and I don't even know what does that other thing. Like, you really have to look at the set as a whole, which is cool from a kind of a tapestry standpoint, like, you know, what little combos can I come up with. I'm sure draft's going to be pretty awesome in terms of like different combinations of things happening all the time, but I don't know if it's my favorite design set. There are certainly some winners, there are definitely cards that are awesome, but as a whole, I'm a little skeptical of the approach they took. Like, I thought the last Rise of Eldrazi was just like, I don't know, it was cool because it was like Timmy's land, like big gigantic creatures doing big awesome things, and you have reasons to get there and do that thing, which is different enough for most men. Like, you're not casting 8 drops and 10 drops and 12 drops in most of Magic, so that alone is cool enough, and we haven't done it in 7 years or whatever. So like, I kind of would have liked just that to be the focal point and not all this weird combo-rific like Phyrexian thing. I don't know, it feels very awkward to me, but I also haven't played the set, so we'll see.
Yeah, so we still have roughly what, like, we probably have seen most of the really interesting or cool cards. There's probably still a few left, but we still have roughly, 100 cards that we'll get by Friday. We're recording on Wednesday that we'll have by Friday.
130 cards.
That's a lot.
Yeah, a lot of it's going to be, you know, common and uncommon limited filler, kind of like the nuts and bolts of decks. Like, we're going to see, like, the 3-mana destroy an artifact. We're going to see the 6-mana sorcery destroy a creature. Like, kind of like the generic stuff that ends up filling out decks and giving everybody access to kind of the tools they need to play in limited. But do you guys want to talk about a couple like really sweet cards we like?
Well, I want to hear your opinion on the difference between Rise of Eldrazi and this, because
So actually, I have a really I think I have a really weird kind of tipping point between the two sets. So Rise of Eldrazi is actually was a lead design effort by someone that I kind of miss in R&D. He moved on to another game company, Brian Tinsman, and what Brian Tinsman did was just weird stuff, and I don't mean that in a derisive way. It's just he had a very, very different design philosophy than many of the other members of R&D, especially those that came off of the Pro Tour and other competitive card games and competitive scenes. So Brian Tinsman was also another set you may recall having a very, very unique feel and different way of playing than you typically experience Magic with, was a little set called Saviors of Kamigawa. It kind of gets a bad rap because it's the third block in a set, and it kind of, it's weird stuff didn't play well with everything else going on in the block. But something that I got to do once, and I have a couple boxes of Saviors sitting in reserve for, is triple Saviors. When all of the cards and all of your decks care about having a full hand and care about the number of cards in your hand, you get a very interesting play dynamic where suddenly you get rewarded for doing weird things like not curving out. And, holding combat tricks or holding extra lands and having like a, you know, extra lands in your deck just to be filler cards in your hand. And it's a really weird thing, you know, and I'm not saying I'm an expert on the triple format or like that's exactly the best way to play it, but in a one-time experience, you ended up with this really different way of playing Magic where suddenly you're much more thoughtful about, do I really want to cast this creature or not? Or do I want to use this combat trick because it's going to take me an extra turn to get back up to, you know, the 7 cards that it turns on. these other abilities that I have going on. And that tension, I think, is what made that set kind of exciting for me. And it's definitely a niche thing, and it's definitely not, I'm saying, something that's great for Magic as a whole. But just as a very different, refreshing experience, it was really cool. I appreciated that. And so I kind of followed Brian, and when I got back into Magic, I kind of paid attention to a little bit to who was designing what. You know, obviously, like, Eric Lauer is very famous for lead designing good draft environments. You know, Innistrad stands out as one that's constantly referred to and well-beloved for having both very linear things and obvious things that you can do, so the layman can kind of jump in and find a deck that they feel like they put together, but also you can do some really crazy stuff like the spider spawning decks and the looping stuff from Exile kind of decks, and just these really interesting, powerful things that you don't normally get to do, and having it all kind of play together. And so I think we kind of have a little bit of rose-tinted goggles when we look back at Rise of the Eldrazi, because we got the experience that Battlecruiser Magic. That's how it was presented. It was, you're going to get, you can have opportunities to cast big fat things. And it felt so dramatically different from Zendikar, which was basically like, do you have infinite two drops? If so, you're probably winning the game. The speed differential between like triple Zendikar and triple Rise of the Eldrazi is huge.
It's definitely the fastest format ever, and I would argue either the slowest or like second slowest format ever back to back. Like Rise of Eldrazi, maybe Avacyn Restored slower, I don't know, but like the very, very slow format. But I also, while I agree with that to a certain degree, I actually work with one of the people who helped design Rise of Eldrazi, Matt Place, who works at Direwolf Digital now.
Very good designer. I liked him too. Yeah.
And I think Rise of Eldrazi has a bit of that Innistrad feel where, like, yes, you are casting giant things and that's awesome, but there's also really cool niche but distinct archetypes that don't necessarily show up every draft, but you always have the option of going into. You could be the crazy wall deck, and by crazy wall deck, there's like two or three different types of wall decks. You have like the ramp wall deck, the wall deck that's pinging them with the Vent Sentinel over and over again. There's the Totem Guide Heart of Beast deck. You got the little I need a bunch of 0/1 Eldrazi spawns plus the three raid party, that was the name of it, enchantment just to lethal people, or I could be the level up deck with the teachers and whatnot. Like, I literally just played a Rise of Eldrazi draft like last week on Moto because they were available, and it's one of my favorite draft archetypes just because there's just so many cool decks. Like, my favorite deck to draft by far was Grixis Control, where you basically try to get some insane 7-man enchantment that like looks unplayable but actually does something cool. Like, the blue one gives your stuff rebound. The black one like reveals the top card of your deck every turn, and you like give something -X -X. I don't even remember. It was like really weird abilities. They're all like 7-mana clunky ass enchantments, and you just like draft one of those as your win condition. Take every rebound spell possible, and you just try to like value your opponent with Stagger Shocks and what was it? Surreal Memoir. That was like my favorite card. 4-mana, return a random instant or sorcery from your graveyard to your hand, and then has rebound. So you just like try to get back to your removal spells, and if those have rebound, you go off. But there's like all these really cool archetypes that. You don't just see them. It's like when you sit down to play an Origins draft, you're going to see a blue-red artifact deck. You're going to see a green-white deck. You're going to see a black-green elf deck. And then there's a couple of lesser archetypes, but for the most part, you see those same archetypes. Just like whether one player has them or whether two player has them, this is the difference. But Rise of Eldrazi and Innistrad, they had these really interesting, like one card that you're just like, this card showed up, it's a rare, I'm going to build around it, let's go. And then you have like this whole new deck just because you opened up that rare. And I think that's lacking on this new set, although I have not played it yet, so I can't say that definitively. And there's a bunch of cards that have not been spoiled. But it seems really hard to draft around single cards when the set is built around synergy so much. Like, the other mechanic is Sunburst, basically. Like, you need to be drafting multiple colors and have good mana, and also, like, you want multiple Sunburst cards because you're getting a better payoff for sacrificing your mana, etc. So it's, like, really hard to take any one card and go, like, let's build around this, because you really need to, like, work this tapestry together. And maybe that's super fun. I don't know. Maybe it's, like, the nut. But Rise of Eldrazi is one of my favorite sets ever, so I'm hoping that this does somewhat of a job, at least in Limited. For Constructed, there are definitely some awesome cards that we're going to talk about in a second. Also, some very wacky designs that I don't think are well-designed, but that's going to happen in every set. So
to jump on kind of what you were saying, Conley, just kind of finish like where I was going with Rise of Eldrazi, because I did take a little long to get there, I'm sorry. The thing that makes Rise of Eldrazi so great for you, and kind of more or less appealing for me, although I'm not the strongest drafter in the format, it was kind of the beginnings of my competitive streak, is that it's so, those little draft around things and those little set up really interesting payoffs and do really interesting weird things, require you to have a lot of skill. Sure. And certainly more skill than the average player that picks up packs. So that's like the major design, you know, kind of shift that was coming right after Rise of Eldrazi came out, the whole New World Order. Like, let's move away from having super interesting and obviously really cool complicated board states and complicated cards that interacted in really interesting ways if you knew what you were doing, into kind of more streamlined and, you know, when you put multiple little things together, suddenly, like, you can draft this archetype, you know, all the archetyping that's really strong, and you can really see in Origins, I think, is a great example of just every color pair has the thing it does.
It's pretty
and you can kind of see that pushing through in all of the sets. And so I get the feeling of homogenization, but it certainly makes it much more accessible to the average player. Because you hand the average player, let me show your first draft in Rise of Eldrazi versus Battle for Zendikar. I strongly suspect Battle for Zendikar is going to go a little better for them, and they're going to feel like they did things that were meaningful and they had a chance versus just, you know, having no clue what's going on. Yeah. I think it's, you know, it's a tension where clearly, you know, I think that the set's leaning one way. And whether that's good or bad is, I think, subjective, but like, I agree that it's missing some of that weirdness that made Rise of Eldrazi stand out.
Where you at, Tom?
We should talk about some cards. We talked about how much this set is awesome. And
Jimmy, you got to talk about card first.
Give us a card, Tom. Come on.
Card first. Oh, my gosh. There's...
All right,
again, I was just...
What were you doing for the last... You weren't listening to us.
I actually was listening. You didn't see me do anything weird. I was actually listening to your love of Rise of Eldrazi.
You didn't put on gloves or condoms or whatever.
Yeah, no, I didn't do anything too weird. I mean, we have some kind of odd reprints. I just talked about how much I know the whole devoid keyword, like you said, Conley, doesn't potentially need to exist, but I overall just love the look of the devoid cards.
So let me clarify. The functionality of devoid and the look of it, I love. You have those frames all day long. I just don't like you have to take up a line on the card, make up a keyword that does effing nothing, basically. Like, Ghostfire does not say devoid on it. It just has in parentheses, this card is colorless. It's a reminder text letting you know the card's colorless, basically. Like, I don't know. I would just be a bigger fan of just do colorless borders. And I think they even mentioned that they tried to do this or they wanted to do this. I think an article I read said that they wanted to, but they weren't allowed or something, rules-wise. But I would have fought for it because I think that the look of the cards is awesome until you just see that top line. Like, think of Sliver Queen. Sliver Queen is an insanely sweet-looking card. And then you read that top line of text and says, Sliver Queen counts as a sliver. And you're like, really? That's what you're leaving with? That's what I know, is that Sliver Queen counts as a teeny sliver? Of course she does. She's a damn sliver.
Well, we used to have, like, the lords, though, that didn't work.
No, I know, exactly. But I'm just saying, they quickly changed that, and they put it all on a type line, and they made it all nightly because the rules didn't allow it back then. And then they made a change, and the rules allowed it. I would have liked to see the same thing for Devoid. They go, oh, the rules don't work. Guess what? It can work now. All right, we're done. Move on. Everyone's happy. That's what I would like. But go ahead. They do look cool. I appreciate the frame. They're sweet. Yeah.
Well, I'll take the one, because I made a complete butthead of myself on our Twitter feed with this, and that's Spawning Bed. So this is a land. It's an uncommon. Tap one. Tap to get a colorless mana. Or six tap, you sack Spawning Bed. You put 3/1/1 colorless Eldrazi Scion creature tokens. So Eldrazi Scions seems to be their term for the 0/1.
No.
They're 1/1s now.
0/1s are now 1/1s in this set.
Oh, they don't, God.
The thought process was 0/1s were kind of had unintuitive gameplay for the most part, which is kind of true. I mean, they're mostly useless things. But now they're 1/1s. Also, the plants in the set are also 1/1s, which is, that one blows my mind.
It's a little different.
I would have liked to keep the plants as 0/1s because that's just like a really cool type of token to have. Like, you're going to want a 0/1 for some reason. Like, sheep's like meh, but like plant is like the perfect 0/1 in my opinion. But regardless, both plants and Eldrazi spawn are now 1/1s and otherwise are functionally similar to what they were.
Well, my mind completely, I honestly didn't even look at the power toughness. In my mind, they were going to be 0/1. So. There you go. Put 3/1/1 Eldrazi Scion creature tokens, and they also have the ability, sack this creature, add 1 to your mana pool. And I said I was upset because when I see Spawning Bed, I think of Homerid Spawning Bed. And I said, well, why doesn't it? I think it would be fun if they made Homerids. And I had never actually read Homerid Spawning Bed, that thing doesn't make Homerids. That I don't know why Wizards decided.
Like crustaceans or something?
Camarids, which is apparently the term for a young Homerid. So I was like, that is oddly, and did you see the tweet that I found? One other card that mentions Camarids. It's like the Sarpathian something volume.
Oh, yeah, that was a Time Spiral throwback card.
Yeah, where you can make like a human, like an elf, a goblin, I think, and then a 1/1 blue Camarid. So even that thing doesn't even acknowledge that Hogwarts exists, so whatever.
All right, can I talk about a different land that activates for 6 mana?
Yes.
All right, because this one's called Blighted Cataract, and it's like 10 times better than Tom's card. Maybe 13 times better. Maybe 50 times better, actually.
I know you.
I'm going to go with 50. So it taps for a colorless mana. It is a land, obviously. And then it has 5 colors and a blue. Tap, sacrifice it, draw 2 cards. So this is a land.
Is it rare or uncommon?
It's uncommon.
Uncommon, okay.
And in a way, it's like it draws you 2.5 cards, because when you draw it the first time, it's a land that produces mana, which is something you want. So you get to use this resource that you desire until you no longer desire it. And it's basically, I mean, it's slightly interactable with, but for the most part, it's going to stay in play without you having to worry about it dying or anything. It's not like a creature that needs to stick around. But so it's going to stay in play, protected for the most part. And then when you get flooded or you, top deck a land in a late game scenario and you're just like, well, I have nothing to do this turn. What am I going to do? You get to just draw 2 cards uncounterable, which is insane. Like this card to me, it's going to be a multiple, like probably a 4 of, I would imagine, in a lot of different decks. The mana in the upcoming format is going to be crazy. In case anybody was not aware, there is fetch lands. There are dual lands that can be grabbed by fetch lands. There are
man lands.
Yeah, there's man lands. There's like basically for the next 6 months until fetch lands are gone, the mana is going to be very, very strong in standard. So by playing something like Blighted Cataract, you are paying a slight cost where you're playing a colorless land. But at the same time, like if you're playing blue-black control and you have 4 of these in your deck and your opponent's playing any other type of control and doesn't have 4 of these in their deck, like you just get to add 1 to 2 extra lands to your control deck, which means you get to play 28 lands and not feel bad about it, because in the late game, 4 of your lands turn into 2 additional cards. Like, this card, I can't... It looks like a simple whatever. This card is phenomenal. Like, absurdly phenomenal. There was a... Tiago Cham's card for the longest time was a land that was a counterspell. You could discard to counterspell something, or it was tap for a mana. That I thought was good. I think this is better, because that you had the tension of, I need to hold this.
You could get value out of it the entire
game. Yeah, whereas this, you just literally, you draw it, you play it, and you set it and forget it, and then later on in the game, it's like, oh, look at this, free cards! This might even see a little bit of modern play, although the modern's a significantly faster format, but some deck might choose to use this just because it is uncounterable. But I would...
Mono-Blutron.
Yeah, maybe Mono Blue Tron, something like that. But yeah, this card is phenomenal. I literally didn't believe it when I first saw it spoiled, because I didn't see the real card. And I was like, they're not going to print a land that draws you 2 cards. Granted, they did print Sowing Salt in the set, a new version of Sowing Salt. Mm-hmm. So there are some measures they're taking for you to deal with lands. There's also the 7 mana exile of permanent. I don't think that's constructive playable, but...
it's a colorless desert twister. Yay.
It's instant, though. So
yeah, it's in a lot of ways, it's strictly better, but...
But yeah, this card is just it's phenomenal. I'm looking forward to it, playing with it in many limited too. I'm sure it's awesome and limited.
Do you feel like the ally encampment land seems awfully strong?
I hate the last line of text on that land. So if it's strong, it's because it produces any color mana.
That's what I mean. Because again, it seems like ally is going to be a pretty strong.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe it depends. I haven't seen too many really constructed quality allies, and if they are, they're not things that care about allies. They just happen to have ally. Like Gideon's constructed playable, but he's just an ally. He doesn't do anything with allies.
The merfolk, the Noyan Dar Royal Shaper, seems certainly strong. He's the 3 white blue. He's a 4/4 merfolk. He's a legendary merfolk ally. Whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell, you may put 3+1+1 counters on target land you control.
Sure, but even then, again, that's not really, like, that's not the ally deck. He just happens to be an ally. So he might see some play, but you're not going to necessarily play the encampment if you're just running this guy. So you need, if I'm running this guy, what other allies am I running in my deck to make me want to play that land?
Oh, do you think we're going to get any ally spells?
There are no ally spells. There are spells that act like ally spells, but they're not pipeline ally.
Do you think that would be something we might see? Or what? Is that just not something they might even give us?
I don't think they're going to reprint Tribal. They did it in Eldrazi, and I don't think they did in this.
They explicitly said that they're not, that Tribal is basically like a
thing of the past.
Trying to think of a good the word for it, depreciated keyword. Like, it's there, it works, but, like, it's not something
that's not coming back.
Yeah, it's like, that's why, like, the void and, like, all the other stuff is kind of, like, there.
And you also have to explain to me why Omnath got so mad in this set. He was a pretty calm little green dude before, but now he is angry.
Fucking eating his
full
planet
of rage.
So there's another card I didn't... I predicted, like, if they were going to do it, like, it would definitely be, like, as soon as I saw Awaken, but, like, I didn't think they would actually do it. This is, like, one of the... looks like one of the cards that came from, like, one of the posters or something that went up in stores. This is Scatter to the Winds. So it's cancel. Counter-target spell, one, double blue. So it doesn't instant... You know, it doesn't seem like that exciting, but it has Awaken 3 on it. So for 4 and double blue, you counter spell and make one of your lands into a 3/3. And kind of pivoting off of what Conley said, like that type of transforming something that no longer has value into a threat or into an advantage in controlling decks, or even just limited. Like, one of the biggest problems with counter spells typically in like limited is like, okay, I stopped a removal spell, but like I didn't actually advance the board, right? I didn't do anything to further my position. I just prevented my position from being eroded. And it's kind of part of the philosophy of doing things that affect the board are generally going to be better than doing things that don't, which is why like the generic, like, cool, I've got this thing that makes my warriors draw cards when they hit. Well, you've got to have the warriors to actually hit first. And like, that, you know, trying to think of the enchantment from Fate Reforged, Raider Spoils, you know, that enchantment by itself doesn't actually do anything to advance your board, but like the warriors you would draft instead of it theoretically do. So Scatter the Winds, being able to counterspell like late in the game, like if I spend 6 mana to stop your 5 drop or your 6 drop or your 7 drop, oh, and I happen to turn this, you know, this 6th land that I already had into a 3/3, you know, untap, play my 6th land again, you know, and I've got a 3/3 dude out of the whole deal, like, that type of tempo play, that type of advancing the board while you're countering a spell kind of solves the it doesn't do anything issue. And I really find that interesting. Like I'm not a big fan of islands and counter spells, and I get all that, but like I feel like this actually does something in a blue deck that I'm drafting. Like, I don't feel like I'm just jamming cancel mindlessly into a deck. It's like a 6 mana, make a 3/3, stop your big 5 drop.
I agree with everything you said, except I hate that this card is rare, just like the last card that I said is rare. This feels like stereotypical uncommon to me. It is cancel, which is a common, plus a pretty simple ability to grok, so upgrade it to uncommon. I don't really get making it rare. It's not like the rate, like if it was Awakened 6 or something crazy where it like made a Kaiga, but like comparing this to Mystic Snake, I guess is maybe where they got to rare. I don't know, but I'm not a big fan of rare, but outside of that, it's a pretty sweet card.
And we've had versions that cost like 4 mana and give you like a 2/2.
Yeah, 2/2 flyer.
Like a 2/2 token. So like I get like a land stronger because like bouncing it doesn't actually like put you down a card, but it kind of does because like you wanted a creature instead of, you know, just a land in this
yeah,
case.
Yeah, you also lost a mana to be able to attack and stuff. So it's
yeah,
like.
So I'm just wondering like what caused that to happen. Like it doesn't feel like it would be broken and limited, but like maybe it couldn't be costed. So it couldn't be costed cancel as an uncommon just because like every blue deck ever would just like run 2 of them and it'd be, sure, you know, kind of awkward. I don't know. Like, I feel like I definitely feel like it was at uncommon at some point. So I'd be interested to learn a little more about
instead
that.
Instead, we got horribly awry at uncommon, which it is colorless, remove soul that only hits things that cost 4 or more. And that feels like a common to me. Outside of like the complexity of it being colorless, but like remove soul was a common and this is like worse than remove soul. I don't know. It's weird. They basically upped the rarity of a lot of things in this set, but whatever. We'll see.
Yeah, from a simple rules question, how does Awaken interact with our new man lands?
If you put 3+1/+1 counters on it, and then it becomes a land.
Always a 3/3, but when I turn into...
It'll be whatever the stats of that card are, +3/+3.
Okay, we'll get those away. Okay. That blue-green hexproof run then is going to be a pain in the ass.
Well, not necessarily, because it's always a land. It's always a creature.
You can always nuke it later on.
It doesn't always have hexproof. You have to pay 4 to give it hexproof. So like, you have to keep 4 mana open at all times. It'll become a 6/6 when you do pay the 4 mana, but it still has vulnerability in terms of like you could just Heroes Downfall it well at the end of turn or the start of your turn when it turns back into just a normal 3/3.
Okay.
So I'm going to throw another card out there. One that I'm very happy about because I feel like it's finally a step in the right direction for making Commander kind of a healthier format in the future. Green Warden of Murasa This is 4 green-green for a 5/4 creature elemental. It's a mythic rare because it's really fine and good. It does stuff. Basically, it's double Eternal Witness. So when it enters the battlefield and when it dies, you return target creature card from your graveyard to your hand. So you get 2 creatures out of it. Not a creature card, any card. Target card. So you get double 2 hits of Eternal Witness off of 1 card. But when it dies, when it goes to that graveyard and it triggers and it gets its ability, to get the ability, you have to exile it. So one of my biggest problems with many commander decks is kind of how redundant and looping kind of the pieces that all fit together can be. So like Greedrunner Morasa is a great card. I think it'll probably see some constructed play just because it can be such a big card advantage engine, just get two of your best whatevers back. Like it kind of feels like it fits into the top end of like some sort of Deathmiss Raptor, kind of just like keep on looping, like you're never going to kill all my dudes. This gets 2 of them back for the price of 1 card. But the fact that it exiles that second time means that it interacts a little bit with like some of the Eldrazi processor stuff, like that Conley hates and whatever, like doesn't make flavorful, doesn't seem to make sense. But just it won't keep going off. Like if somebody gets 2 of these in some sort of like weird, crazy draft, right? Like they're not going to loop them infinitely. Like they're good, but they're not going to get, you know, Greed Warden into Greed Warden into Greed Warden over and over and over. And that's something that already happens in Commander. So I love these really powerful cards that people are going to want to play in decks and want to bring into their big over the top Commander stuff. But it has a self-limiting factor to it. Like it is not just better than Eternal Witness because it's 2 of them jammed together. It's a little different, and you've got to be a little more choosy and careful about how you use it. And I like that.
What's the name of this guy? So maybe you'll know it off the top of your head. Again, this is a card that I think looks like a rare to me. But there was a card in Timespiral. I think it was actually Planar Chaos. It was an uncommon. It had fading. I think it was a 3/6/6, and when it came into play, you returned a creature from your graveyard to your hand, and when it left play, you returned a creature from your graveyard to your hand, and it could loop, and it was a pretty strong card, but like to see this gain 0 keywords, basically just change stats around, it has the same total number of stats, and 6 mana for 9 points of stats, and granted, you can get any card, not just a creature, but it has to exile itself, so therefore can't loop. Basically, not what I'm saying is a small upgrade, but probably not a great upgrade to something that was an uncommon before, and now we're at mythic rare. Like, I think if you just like make this a 6/6 with trample or whatever, I totally buy it as a mythic. But it's like a titan at that point, sort of. But as is, I'm kind of let down by the rarities. Like, they did some awesome things. I don't know if you saw the new Horn Turtle. That guy excites me. He's a common Horn Turtle with like 10 upgrades on Horn Turtle.
Yeah.
He's colorless. He's unblockable. And he has, I don't even remember. He's got Ingest.
So
he's got like a bunch of like, he's like Horn Turtle walking around with a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, you mentioned unblockable too. It was just a bunch of stuff they threw on.
Yeah, he's walking around with like a bunch of chains on and banging his flavor clock. And that's awesome. But if you're willing to take a common, add 3 things onto it, and still leave it a common, don't take like an uncommon, basically just shift some stuff around, and all of a sudden it's a mythic. Like, it feels really strange to me. But at the same time, this card is sweet. I would gladly draft it every single time. I'm sure it's awesome in Commander. I don't know if it's good enough in Constructed because it itself, you're like paying 6 mana for a 5/4 is pretty lame, so which means you're really relying on its ability. And usually cards that rely 100% on their ability are kind of risky at this mana cost because you want your 6 mana card to actually win you the game and not just get you back a Rampant Growth or something. But at the same time, I don't know. It could definitely see play. I don't know.
I totally miss that there's a new Take an Extra Turn card. I somehow missed that one coming out.
I also missed that till I just saw it on the spoiler when we went over to cancel. It cost 9 mana to take an extra turn and make a 6/6 though, which is pretty expensive.
Just that one got by me.
Boy, that feels okay.
Yeah,
that's an awesome mythic. Makes that a mythic all day long.
Yeah, also like both modes are expensive enough that I'm fine with it in Commander. Like it's not like the stupid like 5 mana and then get it back every turn. It also exiles itself.
Yeah, that's just
why I like it. Like, go ahead, take 1 extra turn and make a 6/6. I'm cool with that. I'll take a punch from your 6/6 when you untap with it and hit me with it next turn. That's great. I just know you're not taking 8 more turns after that.
It's worth mentioning that in this environment, exiling things, whether it's Dove, whether it's Part the Water Veil, whether it's that green guy we just talked about, does have some costs because your opponent now has fodder for their things without having to get it there themselves. So you are potentially there's some risk there. I don't know if that'll come in standard, but I could easily see it mattering. Also, the reason we didn't know about this part of the water veil is it was spoiled 12 minutes ago. So.
Oh, really? Okay. That will explain. So I just hit refresh. I was like, huh, that one I don't remember.
So I think I found my favorite ally. So there's like Munda, the ambush
The green leader. Guy, the green haste one. That gives you
no, I mean, the green haste one's okay. My favorite ally is one that I had a very interesting conversation with last week in a Grand Pilgrimage meet.
You talked to the card itself? Master. That's amazing.
No, no, no. With somebody else about the card, obviously, okay. Tom. Three red, white for a 2/2 human soldier ally rally. Whenever Resolute Blademaster or another ally enters the battlefield under your control, creatures you control gain double strike until end of turn. So we had a discussion because it was like somebody was like, that card's like really expensive. It doesn't do a lot. But like for me, like I don't look at it as like a 2/2 creature.
Well, it's a creature, so it's everybody.
Right. I mean it gives basically I look at it as three red white for a sorcery that says creatures you control gain double strike this turn. Put a 2/2 human soldier ally. Onto the battlefield. Like, that's what I read it as. Because, like, I'm clearly not planning on going, you know, double strike, double strike, double strike, double strike every turn for the rest of the game. But it's one of those things where, like, if I'm drafting an aggressive deck, which is what I like to draft, and red-white, which are my two favorite colors to be aggressive in, you know, curving out and having, you know, on turn six, you know, giving all of my dudes double strike and just like demolishing the race, making all of their planned trades into like just like chump blocks or forcing them to trade with they're bigger creatures rather than their small ones. That one turn of double strike is huge. And I love that as just like a go over the top, kind of like an overrun effect sorcery. But the fact that I get a token out of it and I get a potential upside to have it happen again is great. But I'm just looking at it as like a finishing sorcery for the aggressive deck.
I would have liked to see this particular card be a 3/1 just so that you have huge incentive to give a double strike the following turn. Like you want to play an ally because 3 doubles to 6 is so much better. And obviously 1 toughness makes it less likely to attack into something without double strike. Outside of that, I think the card's pretty sweet. That's my analysis.
Outside of it, you think the card is
sweet.
Yeah.
Probably not constructed playable just because for 5 mana you can just get an enchantment that gives yourself double strike all the time.
Yeah, I mean this is totally like one of those, you know, I want to draft. It gives me a creature, but it's like the same as a spell slot for me. Like it fulfills both roles. Like I just like those kind of cards in my decks. I'm trying to think of a good comparison. Like the wasn't there a creature in Dragonsturk here where like other things that like weren't ferocious or whatever couldn't block that turn?
Yes. I forget what it was called, but yes.
Yeah, like that was super situational. Like it turned out like it was not very good just because like there weren't enough like things to make that deck work right. But like that type of effect is like what I, you know, like if it was like everything, you know, if it was just like a normal dude that said, you know, things that were ferocious can't block this turn. Like suddenly the, you know, all the aggressive decks just would pick that card up all day. It feels very similar to like a Barrage of Boulders type effect. Like it just finishes the game on the spot.
Do we talk about, I'll talk about a different Eldrazi. Have we talked about Ulamongo? I don't think we have.
No, I don't think so.
All right, I'll save that one for Tom. But
go for it. We'll share. We'll hold hands going into this one together.
Well, see, the thing about Ulamog is it's really only one line of text that's relevant to talk about, which is the cast. Like when you cast it, exile 2 permanents. That ability is insane. Obviously, more than twice as good as the last Ulamog's ability, which destroyed a single thing, did not exile it, cost the same amount of mana, actually cost one more. This cost 10, that cost 11, I believe. Kozilek cost 10. So you spent one more mana to destroy one permanent versus killing 2 untargetable, whatever. This guy, they're both indestructible. This one has a significantly worse attack trigger. Exiling 20 cards is just worse than Annihilator because, I mean, I guess in some number of worlds you're going to win before you kill them with this guy, I guess, by decking them. But usually you'd rather affect the board by making them sacrifice 4 permanents. But yeah, I mean, if we're seeing this Ulamog in standard, it's because we want to cast it, exile 2 cards, and now our opponent has to deal with this 10-10, which seems extremely strong. Worth noting, though, is that this Ulamog does not shuffle in, so running it as like a 1-of win condition in your deck is not a thing. Well, I mean, it could be a thing because it is indestructible and it does have an effect. So, you know, if you're playing this with like, you know, that land that Tom mentioned earlier, make some 1/1s and stuff like that, and like have a backup plan, some planeswalkers or whatnot. You could have this as a 1/1 condition, but it is not going to serve the same role that Kozilek did, where you're just looping it over and over again. But yeah, that's the only relevant part to talk about that guy, is exiling 2 cards. He's not actually that exciting to talk about, but he'll be exciting to play, so that's cool, I guess. I want to talk about Void Winnower, though, because it's a super weird card.
It is very bizarre.
So, I tried so hard. I saw it. Like, I got the card, right? This is my preview card last week. I saw the card, and I'm like, I can't even. Oh, God. This is all anybody's going to talk about. Like, so I specifically avoided using that in my preview. Like, I did everything in my power to try to head that off. Like, let me talk, like, let me play off of winnowing. And I just ran with that the whole time. Like, you know, made, like, winnowing, like, windows and winnowing, like, you know, whittling. And, like, I used a bunch of, like, kind of, like, things like that just to try my best to get that literally can't even thing off the table. And, like, obviously, like, it was just completely fruitless. Yeah. I've lost.
Yeah, of course. It's instant meme. Like, so basically, Void Winnower is 9 mana, 11/9. It's a creature all draws, 8 colorless. And when it's in play, your opponent turns into a teenage girl. So what that means is your opponent cannot cast spells with an even converted mana cost. And they remind you that 0 is even in case anybody did not go to junior high school. And then your opponents can't block with creatures that have even greater mana costs. So basically, your opponent literally can't even while this thing is in play. Maybe that was done intentionally as a joke. I don't know. I assume not. But at the same time, the card is extremely interesting as a result. Like, I don't think this card's actually good. I don't imagine, like, if you reanimate Iona, you lock somebody out of the game usually. If you reanimate this, you could lock somebody out of the game, but like in modern, past exiles, when most played removal spell or whatever, that costs 1 mana, so you're not doing yourself any favors there. And in standard, I don't know, like the new hero's downfall is still 3 mana, cancel is still 3 mana. You have like a bunch of good 5 mana planeswalkers, like the new Obnixilus would kill this. I basically think that there are too many scary things running around that just nuke this at an odd mana cost, I guess is what I'm looking for.
So, I think all of the Wrath effects, like...
Yeah, all the Wrath effects
are and Hostility, Crux of Fate, and the new white one with Awaken all are 5 mana to cast.
Yeah. Even if you happen to play the new 7 mana colorless exile card, like, that works too. I don't know. Basically, the card, it seems really interesting. I could see a metagame come about where this card maybe sees a little bit of play as some weird reanimation thing, but most likely it's just going to be an annoying card that your friend who really likes to see people suffer in Commander is
going
to play.
Yeah, this is going into the Mathematician's
Wet Dreams. Yeah, this is Mathematician's Wet Dreams. Yeah, Angel.
Because, I don't know, all the other crap, so you literally don't know when you cast a spell if you even can yet. So you're like, okay, I have to add 3 and then, nope, I can't.
You know what the worst part about this card is? And you have to set all your Chalice of the Voids before you cast this, because every Chalice of the Void has an even converted mana cost. Oh, no, this only works for your opponents. Never mind. So you could do it.
You can do anything. That's what's kind of fun from my side when I was thinking for the Commander deck was...
Yeah, so you just have to Chalice for 3, Chalice for 5, Chalice for 7, then you cast this guy, and you basically won the game, Tom.
So, something interesting, and obviously I don't know the rules well enough to kind of go into your Mathematician's Wet Dream deck, Tom, but I was listening to a level 3 talk to some, I believe some level 1s and 2s about Void Winnowers. Like, so if I have Void Winnower out, can I cast things like Chalice of the Void and Hangerback Walker? And so, it turns out, here's the thing, turns out before Magic Origins, the legality of the ability to even cast the spell was checked before, like, first, right? So, like, I go to cast Chalice of the Void. Well, Chalice of the Void, you know, it has a mana cost of 0, you know, in my hand. I wouldn't even be allowed to start casting it. After this past Magic Origins rules update, where they check if you can or can't cast a spell is now, like, partway into the process of casting a spell, which means the converted mana cost of the spell gets locked in before, like, the check happens to say, hey, can you cast it or not? Which means with Void Winnower, you can Chalice for 1, and you can Chalice is XX, correct?
Yeah, so it's always going to be even.
So Hangerback Walker and Chalice of the Void, you can...
In this set, we have Endless 1, it's just X.
But, like, something like Astral Cornucopia, the XXX... mana rock. You can cast it for anything that'll result in an odd cost. So like you can cast it for, you know, one mana, three mana. Basically any multiple of mana where the total converted mana cost of that spell becomes odd.
Sure.
And it's just like one of those little things where like before it like would have wrecked tons of spells. It turns out it's a little different now. And like Endless One. Like for example, I can cast an Endless One against, you know, Voidwinter where I couldn't, you know, a year ago.
You can't cast an Endless One for 8 with a Voidwinter out.
Correct.
But you can do it for like Am said before, you couldn't even try.
Handily enough, 9.
Hmm. Nice. Then I can block and kill the Voidwinter.
Yeah,
and then I yell, "We just got even."
11-9 is a very strange set of stats. Like I understand that they both had to be odd, clearly, but 11-9 is kind of weird. I would have preferred 7-11. What?
I love 7-11.
Pick two odd stats. 7-11.
I think 7-11 is spot on.
Yeah.
At that point, just make like I don't know 18-1. Or by 17-1. Make it something just ridiculously stupid at that point.
No, but a 7-11 is no more stupid than an 11-9.
Okay, we could keep the same total of 20 power toughness, make it a 19-1.
It doesn't have to be 20. Like, if anything... No, I guess you could... Any two odd numbers are going to equal even numbers.
Yeah. You're talking about that junior high math stuff again there, so yeah.
Hey, I figured it out before even saying it out loud, so clearly I know how to do the math, Tom.
Yeah, luckily they changed the rules of magic, otherwise you wouldn't even be able to think about it. You just couldn't even talk about it.
Thanks for making that topical.
Mm-hmm.
You can go back.
That's why I make the big bucks on this podcast.
All right, what's our next? Oh, Tom, it's your card. Go.
Oh, next what, for me?
One more card, Tom. Last one.
Oh, yeah, go for it. I mean, there's...
Pick a card. Let's close this out. Yeah, your card.
Shower us with your casual ignorance.
Oh, I got a ton of casual ignorance from this one. I guess the one for me that I just thought was potentially interesting because it was sort of a... I'm trying to think of what to compare this to. Quarantine Field. Just because I like cards... Quarantine Field, white, XX. So already in my mind, I should be getting like 4/4 angel tokens out the wazoo when I'm casting this. Quarantine Field enters the battlefield with X isolation counters on it. I just like the idea of an isolation counter. When Quarantine Field enters the battlefield, for each isolation counter on it, exile up to one target non-land permanent an opponent controls until Quarantine Field leaves the battlefield.
Is that right? Let me know when you're done speaking.
I'm done talking about it. I want to see what
Does this have counters on it? Why?
As a designer, I thought you might have some fun topics on this one.
Why does it need ice? Tom, can you explain why it needs isolation counters?
Because
you
know why?
Because
cool.
It's some stupid rules loophole that Dell was like, we got to fix this. It doesn't work. You can't just have XX white enchantment exile X creatures. That would make way too much sense. Instead, we have to put some counters on it that don't matter at all unless you have doubling season out.
No, and they do.
The counters, you have to take a die, put that die on top of your quarantine field to show how many creatures are underneath it, even though all the creatures are sitting underneath it. It's stupid.
I agree, because it doesn't, if the counters change later on, it doesn't affect the function.
No, the counters do not matter once the counters have
hit. They do matter. So why they matter, Conley, is super straightforward. And like I'm not dismissing you here, but the reason they matter is because there's no memory. Once enchantment resolves on the battlefield,
I understand the technical
no memory of what X was spent.
I so understand
you
that
put the counters on. To know how many things you're going to exile.
I understand technically that is the rules, but if this did not have counters on it and you showed it to any player ever, would they be confused with how many creatures they get to exile? My point is, like, make the game accessible and common sense, and you get to cut down so much of this crap. Like, literally, it loses 3 lines of text if you get rid of that. The card becomes clean, easy to read. Everybody knows what's going on. Hell, people will probably still put a die on top of it every once in a while as counters that aren't actually there. But the game just I personally think that like having this really technical, weird rulesy things is just kind of like lame. Like I can't think of any card that is like this. This is basically the first enchantment that has X and what
What happens if, so I cast my quarantine field. I say it's for three, whatever. So I've got three, you know, really badass cool isolation tokens on my quarantine field. And I am playing an Eldrazi deck just because that's the way that I roll. And I have now cast a... God, which ones do shit to the cards? Processors? Which ones take stuff from exile and put them into the graveyard?
Oh, yeah. Somebody can do that with a card from this.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of them. So I have now come out. I processed, you know, I have ingested, I then crapped it out to the graveyard to get some sort of amazing effect out of that card. Someone now comes along and nukes my quarantine field. What happens to that card that I previously had exiled that's now staying in someone's graveyard?
Well,
it's not in exile anymore. It's not there.
Yeah, it's not
like,
in exile.
Like, the card only tracks it in the zone that it puts it in. So, for example, like, if there's anything that, Rift Sweeper and like other stuff like that. Like if once it moves zones, it's just like when something goes to the graveyard and comes back. Like you use a Planeswalker, right? Use its ultimate ability, it goes to the graveyard. Then
so
you use some spell that brings
it
back.
Did.
It's okay. A totally different card. It loses track of like it doesn't know that it already activated its ability. That
I'd rather have that on the card
It's worth noting here that the cards that Harvest or whatever, the herders and stuff like that, they take cards that your opponents own from exile and put them into your opponent's graveyard. So in order for the scenario you're talking about to happen, I would have had to have been the one to cast the field, exile my opponent's creature, and then put that creature back into their graveyard. So I can't get my own creature back from their field and put it in my graveyard because that's my creature. I think these only work on your opponent's exile stuff. So you can enable it better that way, but at the same time, you know, you are putting something in the graveyard that they could use for, you know, I don't know, maybe it matters.
See, I'm a little surprised, Conley, you didn't rail about quarantine field, because I think in like 60 to 90% of the games where you're going to see it in like limited, and I think even constructed for that matter,
X of one.
It's basically going to be double Oblivion Ring. Like, you pay 6 mana, 4 colorless, sure, and 2 white, and you just have a double Oblivion Ring.
Oh, I mean, the card's very strong. I think it'll see a ton of play. My issue is not with... I do have a couple issues. One, the double X is a little weird with the Starfield of Nyx or whatever it is. I don't like that. Basically, like, that's the kind of the marquee white enchantment, and then you have this new cool enchantment that comes out, and you spend a bunch of mana on it, and you end up with a 2/2. But whatever, that's fine. But it's just the counters. I just think that the counters is kind of messy, and it's just too technical. And literally, if you showed this card without any mention of counters anywhere on it, and you showed XX white white to people, outside of the nerdiest judges, nobody would have said anything or bad an eye, because everybody would understand exactly what it meant. Nobody was even knew that rule existed, that it doesn't check memory. Like, it would just make sense intuitively, and I think that's the kind of direction that I would prefer to go. But at the same time, the card exists as is now, so like, I'll play with it. It's good. It's strong.
So it reminds me kind of a roundabout way to a different card from World Wake. So you remember Multi-Kicker? There was Marshall's Anthem, which is basically Glorious Anthem, but when you Multi-Kicker it, you get to return some dudes from your graveyard to the battlefield. Basically, it's kind of like that combination of like, oh, I can get all these like super cheap weenies back, and they're even better than before.
Yeah.
I'm kind of wondering if could this have worked the same way where like, you know, where it instead of saying enters the battlefield, the X isolation counters on it, when blah 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 enters the battlefield, it says as it enters the battlefield, and using it as kind of like a spell resolution ability. Like that's a question I'll ask Matt Tabak. Like, I'm gonna see him, you know, like 2 days or whatever. Like,
yeah, I feel
like maybe if there was a cleaner way, they would have gone with it. I'm just wondering like what made it impossible to be like the smoothest, cleanest version.
That's fair. Marshall's Anthem, for anybody, the exact text is, when Marshall's Anthem enters the battlefield, return up to X target creature cards from your graveyard to the battlefield, where X is the number of times Marshall's Anthem was kicked. So it somehow is able to recognize how many times it was kicked, but not recognize what an X cost and its mana cost was, which is weird to me, because this is a triggered ability. It says when it enters the battlefield, not as. And the text of the card is, by the way, 2 colors, white, white. Creatures you control get +1/+1, and then Multi-Kicker, colorless white. So somehow, the game allows you to check the number of times you kicked a card while casting it, in memory-wise, but not the X's you paid in the mana cost. Like, does anybody not get how this baffles my mind, that somehow we live in a magic world where there is a difference in the memory tracking of the number of mana you spent in Multi-Kicker versus the number of mana you spent in the casting cost? That just blows my mind. So, I mean, we are where we are, but I would have fought hard and long to get a Marshall's Anthem wording on that card. I think it would have made it a lot clearer. But
okay, can I ask you guys a Vorthos question before we move on to non-BFC stuff?
Sure.
This is one I wish I could ask the artist what they were sent. And the art I'm wondering about, because I can't tell what it is Coastal Discovery.
Oh, okay. It's a penis on a beach.
Yes. So Coastal Discovery, which I agree, it looks like I assume if an Eldrazi had a penis, this is what the Eldrazi penis would likely look like, because it has spikes and looks just awful. Is 3 and a blue, sorcery, draw 2 cards. You does have an awaken, 4 and a blue, or 5 and a blue, 4. I literally can't tell what the art is. It looks like some rocks. I think
it's mostly like, it looks like the waves are all kind of pulling back and there's like something on the seafloor, and I would guess that's like a staff of some kind or whatever. But some flavor text or something, some context there definitely would have helped. Like, I don't really know. It kind of looks like a conch on a...
Yeah, have they shown us any equipment or anything in this set?
No. I think all the colors... I don't think they're going to do a ton of artifacts because of the color stuff, and the artifacts they are going to do are going to be very loud. They've done Hedron Archive and Hedron Network and then Pilgrim's Eye. So all those things are like very themed reasons to be artifacts.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the Coastal Discovery art, Tom, and because it has Awaken, I'm wondering if like...
Oh, that's the land.
If it's supposed to represent like giant like crustacean type pieces, where like when the land comes alive, it's like, oh, it's got like crab like pieces on it because it's clearly like coming alive from under the water, you know? Like it definitely seems like maybe it was meant to be art for something else, because this does.
That's what I was kind of
thinking. They could have had art for like some sort of powerful like, you know, colored artifact. Or something like that, where it's like, cool, it's like this is like the super blue staff thing, and like turns out they have Thassa's trident and Kiora's hand, and
I'm trying to look at the art on our Noyan Dar royal shaper, because he's holding like a staff with a conch on. I'm trying to look to see if that is the same. Yeah, it's a little different to me, though.
It's a little different, but it's not that far different. Like, it's got like a spiky top, and like it's got like a like curl thing over it. Like, you take those little pieces off, and like it looks a lot similar. The two pieces in the middle, you know what I'm talking about, where then it'll just look like a long spine.
Yeah,
coming off of like a spiky thing. Like, they're not that different. Like, maybe it's supposed to represent that story moment. Like, cool, I found the staff that lets me make the land really angry.
See, I'm a simple guy. I just want Grove Rumbler. I just want an elemental that just beats stuff to death with a tree.
So, by the way, while we're talking about random blue cards, another strange decision to me, Prism Array. So I think the card's pretty wacky. It's a converge card, so it's got what is the word I'm looking for?
Wooburg.
Yeah, you cast, for every color mana, it comes into play with a counter. It costs 4 colors and a blue, so you can spend all 5 mana on it. It has remove a counter to tap something. Sure, I'm there with you. It's called Prism Array. You put something in a prism. Then it has pay all 5 color mana, scry 3. So like, I'm kind of there with you in that, like, Prism, you spend 5 mana, but scrying 3 and tapping something, like, they're kind of already like weird metaphors to, like, put together. But the thing that baffles my mind is not the design. I mean, the design of this card is pretty weird, but they then decided to put the reminder text for what scry 3 is after a card that already had, like, 6 lines of text on it minimum, because it has all kinds of stuff about converge and removing counters and spending 5 colors of mana. Like, scry is an evergreen mechanic. This is a rare, you don't need to put reminder text
and
for scry.
And in the same set, we have Ugin's Insight, 3/3, 2 blue, yeah. Sorcery. It talks about scry, but even with an X in it at that point.
Yeah, it's a scry X, and it doesn't tell you what scrying does.
Huh.
Like, so it blew my mind that this just, they were like, yeah, we're fine adding 4 additional lines of text to this card to tell you what scry 3 does. And the card, it has like a combined 10 lines of text after that when it just didn't need it. Like, that's the kind of thing where it's like, just make the cards, make them look cooler, right? Like, put flavor text where it's necessary, remove crappy text where necessary. If I was in there, I would just be the janitor. I'd be walking around cleaning up everything after everybody.
He's just like, got a red marker.
Don't get to put reminder text for this scry on this damn card. Put it on your common that says, give something +3/+3. Reminder everyone then.
The last one I just want to mention, I just thought was kind of a cool Eldrazi, was Fathom Feeder. Just because any card that seems like it has an activated ability that just draws you cards usually is good. Blue and black.
Another card I hate. Why are you bringing up every card I hate, Tom?
Because if there was a spectrum to Magic players, kindly, I'm pretty sure we are pinning down the two opposite ends of that one.
All right. Well, no. Again, I hate them for their design purposes, not because the card's not strong. Like, that card, I'm certain I will play with it before it rotates. I'm certain it is a strong card, but it is a two mana, 1/1 death touch, which tells me a story of, hey, you should probably use this defensively and throw it in front of a big guy and lose it and trade up. That's great. And then it has Ingest, which says, no, 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 don't trade it with that big guy. You need to keep this thing around, and you need to make it hit your opponent, because then you get your Ingest. But wait a second, if I'm attacking you because I want to get this Ingest off, I'm exposing my 1/1 death touch to all your like crappy 1/1 tokens that I normally don't want to trade my 1/1 death touch up for. That's kind of strange. But wait! For 5 mana, you could just draw cards and exile things without ever having to attack. So what you're really supposed to do is cast your 2 mana 1/1
sit on it.
That's supposed to attack, and then sit on it and draw cards. It like blows my mind that it's just like he's like pulling everyone in every direction. It's like, what am I doing with this card? But that said, it does so many things that like there's very rarely you're going to draw it on a board state and go, well, I don't have anything to do with this card. Like if you're behind, you're trading it. If you're ahead, you're attacking and drawing cards, whatever. So it'll probably play fine. But in terms of like, you know, which player is like really excited about this? It's pretty much Tom. That's it.
Yeah, that's, I thought it was cool. And I'm gonna have to make note cards. Remember what a drone processor and everything else is for these guys.
At least all my ramblings and rants have some rationale behind them this time. You have that going for me.
Yeah. I'm just glad that you were excited for a card that's basically a super horned turtle. That is my takeaway from this entire podcast.
Awesome. When you take a card, you put 3 very small upgrades on it, the card changes completely. Like, that Horned Turtle plays so much differently than Horned Turtle. That Horned Turtle wants to attack. It wants to ingest things, and then every once in a while, you're going to block with it because it's a Horned Turtle. Like, to me, that's awesome design. It really reshapes what we already know about the game versus a lot like some of these other designs, which certainly reshape what we know about the game, but do it in a very complex, kind of ineloquent way. And I don't know. I think the set has some really cool things going on. Like, Deathstalker is a really cool card.
It's a common... Popper Q.
Dustalker is not a con. Oh, yeah, the Horned Turtle's a con.
Horned Turtle, yes. Yeah, not the Fathom dude.
Kiora, I love the Kiora design. I love Obnixilus. I think both Planeswalkers, or even all 3, Gideon is also an awesome Planeswalker. Like, I think the Planeswalkers have done really well. But then there's cards like Skyrider Elf. And I'm like, what is Skyrider Elf has an X in its mana cost that is not referenced anywhere else on the card?
Well, just you so you can do your Sunburst over the...
Yeah, I understand what it's there for. I'm an intelligent player, but
put isolation counters on it.
Every other X card in the history of Magic, you've looked up somewhere else on the card and it tells you what that X does. This guy just doesn't mention it ever again. You're like, what?
I can spend 1,000 mana on this. And then what was its? Oh god, isolation counters would have fixed that.
Also, it's an ally, which just throws it for like an extra like woo. But yeah, I don't know. There, like I said, there's some really cool designs in the set and some ones that baffle me. But hopefully, it all plays well. I'm excited to play.
It seems like I've. This is probably one of the sets in the recent future. Like, Magic Origin System really excited me. This one just looks fun to play.
Oh, it's got all kinds of crazy whack in it. Like, if you want to experience some unique game states, like, read March from the Tomb and then tell me what happens after you cast that. You can't. You don't know. You're returning some number of allies that are having some number of triggered abilities. You could like, do anything with that card. Like, there are plenty of open-ended, really cool cards in the set.
From a power level, what was your guys' thoughts on the Woodland Wanderer? So this is the 3 green. He's a 2/2 creature elemental, vigilance, trample, but has converged. So it enters the battlefield with +1/+1 counter on for each color of mana spent on it. So by default, it's a 3/3 for 4.
But feels like, trample.
Yeah, but it feels like common. This is going to be at least a 4/4 for 4. I was just kind of curious if you guys thought this was going to be
From a competitive standpoint, I expect this card to see a pretty heavy amount of play. Like,
okay.
3 color, like Abzan gets just cast a 3 mana or 4 mana 5/5 Vigilance Trample, which is like goes pretty well alongside Seed Rhinos. Mm-hmm. Also, it has a 3 mana draw 3 lose 3 life, which is absurd. So Abzan might be getting strong, but yeah, this card, if you cast at least if you spend 2 different colors of mana on it, it's acceptable. If you spend 4, then you have a 4 mana 6/6 Vigilance Trample, which is pretty absurd. So in a competitive standpoint, I expect this will see a ton of play. I assume any Sunburst card has some appeal in casual. Adam knows more about that.
Yeah. Okay, guys, I kind of blow what I had. Do you guys have a last card or two you wanted to mention?
No.
Have a brutal.
Adam just.
I have no more.
Adam Snow was so silent.
No further comments.
Off of Tom.
Sounded like Prince. And then he kicked my ass and they made me pancakes.
No, I mean, the thing is like, I'm going to have more, like, when there's, like, more commons and stuff to talk about. Yeah. Those are also, like, the cards, like, people, like, talk about. I mean, I think we hit all the super sweet points. I think we talked about some of the cool constructive potential that's coming. And
what about the common
about
lands?
The stuff we don't like.
The ones that the
common... I'm pretty much the only one that ran into.
You got a Mathematician's Wit Dream card. Come on, Com.
Yeah. No, I was just curious, from a common standpoint, what do you think of kind of the new, what do they call them, Expedition Lands? What are people calling the new?
Oh, the green one is crazy, I think. The green one is crazy good. Because, so, one thing to keep in mind with the lands, I'm not going to read every single one because they all have, like, different abilities. The green one specifically, they all interplay tap. They all tap for a mana of their color. Green one says, look at the top five cards of your library. If you do, reveal up to one basic card from among them, put the rest on the bottom of your library, and that one on top. Mm-hmm. So, seems pretty... like fair. I don't think it's like a crazy like power level card. I think some number of decks might choose to run this, some number of decks won't. But the important thing to remember with this card is you always, even if there's a basic land, have the option to fail to find. So if you draw this in the late game, you're like, I really don't want to screw my next draw step and put a land on top. You can remember that you still look at the top five cards. You're still putting those five cards on the bottom of your library in any order. But you can, because it asks you to reveal a specific type of card.
Well, it says up to. And then, yeah. So if you had a basic land, you could still choose not to show it, correct?
Correct, and you can put them all on the bottom, which is, like I said, it's important because I think it, during the pre-release, some number of players are going to draw this and then not cast the card, not play the card because they don't want to mana or like mana flood themselves next turn. But just remember that you can always skip that. And obviously, early on, like there's going to be some number of hands, one land you keep because you have a Fertile Ticket, and that's kind of cool.
Yeah, the that cycle is just absolutely bonkers for Pauper Cube. I mean, Alex Ullman on Gathering Magic got to talk about it, and I did like a little Pauper Cube tidbit for it. So like, Skyline Cascade is just like super sweet for you know, blue white flyers and you know, blue red counter decks like Counterburn. Just like being able to lock down something that's like bashing in to you for a turn is just super nice. Basically, you get like that spell effect without having to like put another spell in your deck. It's just like a free spell you get to add. And Mortuary Mire is, I think it's like just like a great card overall.
That card's gonna see standard play. I'm pretty sure. Like just getting back a Siege Rhino and guaranteeing an extra. Like it has the opposite effect of the green one, which is in the late game I guarantee gas next turn, which is just huge.
Well, there's some tension there, right? So like if the Eldrazi, like the Ingesters kind of become like a thing, like putting something on top of your deck is also like basically could be like saying exile that instead.
Sure.
Which is kind of be like an interesting
I mean, I don't know if the Ingesters are seeing play in standard, obviously you would obviously not cast your Mire at that point, and you would try to set it up and kill their Ingesters first or whatever. I don't think Ingesters will be popular enough to make Mire not a card just because it's so strong at getting back. Like, literally don't have to mention another card besides Siege Rhino. Like, how many Siege Rhinos do you want to draw in a game? And the answer is all of them every turn. So,
yeah. And I just put like kind of like a black green mill, like self mill graveyard value archetype into my cube, kind of reformatted it from just kind of being like generic grindy stuff to like I get like value out of the graveyard, and it runs like Grisly Salvage and a couple effects like that, just a few to like help accelerate into some of the delve cards. So like Mortuary Mire is just like an excellent card for my cube for that effect. Like it's way better than like Piranha Marsh. Like ping your opponent one life is not very sexy for a land coming to play tapped, and Bojuka Bog's super situational, and it doesn't even want to be in the non-black decks anyway. Happy to have like all the on-color effects be useful for the decks that would want to draft them.
I am happy that Bojuka Bog's a card, though, because I think that card existing in general is cool for the game.
Yes. Yeah. It's just in the context of my cube, it's not very
limited
there. Yeah. So finding the getting five lands that have all useful effects on color is just great.
And I'm still torn. I guess I'm excited to see kind of the rest of the filler for this set, because I feel from the you know, for playing Eldrazi, which for me is tribal, that is kind of what I'm drawn to much more than the allies for some reason.
I was going to ask what you think about them splitting up the manlands. So first of all, I'm calling them manlands. I apologize if anyone's offended, but that's just what they've been called for forever. I do not mean
I guess that is a kind of a sexist. I never thought of it. But
I mean, it's not.
It's just always what I've called them.
To me, I say it because it's a rhyme thing. It's like really easy to say. Like calling them creature lands or something like that is just really hard to say. And the whole point of nicknaming something is to like make it easy on the tongue. So, but it. I'll add that caveat. Regardless, it's weird to me that they chose, at least as far as I know, to not put them all in this set. There's only two or three, and then they're putting other ones in the other sets. Is that true, Adam? Do you know?
Yeah, I think Rosewater specifically said that on his blog.
So these are the only three we're going to get, I assume, right? Or wait, how many?
There's only two.
Oh, sorry. I was looking at I saw a Prairie Stream.
3/3 Hexproof and 2/3 Lifesteal are the two current ones. Or Lifelink, sorry. I play too much League of Legends. What? They're literally, I mean, it's the same in every, like, in Diablo, it's lifesteal, it's like, whatever.
Yeah, so I just got curious because when I see the Eldrazi cards, it feels like there are sort of two deck archetypes to present to you. One would be almost like the old mono brown, where I'm going to be playing as much acceleration as possible so I can poop out, like, you know, 8, 9, 10 huge monster colorless creatures. Or I'm going to be playing almost like a crazy multicolored deck so I can play all these different drones and processors where I'm likely not getting up to the 8, 9 guys. I'm going to be, you know, maxing out like 4, 5, maybe 6. So I keep
waiting. I don't know. I think there's a lot of Eldrazi stuff that costs a specific color of mana. Like I feel like the Eldrazi are going to skew like blue and black, and
well, I feel like
in that direction, and then like the non-Eldrazi decks are going to be more like more, you know.
Well, I feel like there's a deck already that we've seen that you just play all the, you know, colorless mana accelerators you can do. You got the Hedrons. I mean, Kozilek's Chandler is not great acceleration by any means, but I guess you have some of the green, you know, land pullers that you could do. You just live until you get up to 7, so you can start scouring from existence and Titan's presence, everything in sight, until you poop out Ulamog or Desolation Twin. So you get this, 2 10-10s.
Tom's getting very excited by this.
I thought Eldrazi were really cool, but for me, we just didn't have as many of them. Now that it's actually a well-developed tribe, to me, that's really interesting.
That's true. The Eldrazi from before were very limited in terms of the big colorless ones. A, because there was only one set, so they couldn't do it across multiple sets, which we should get this time. But also, B, I think that it was treading on such new territory that it's kind of scary to, like, pitch a set that has a bunch of 8-drops and 9-drops and 10-drops and 11-drops. So, like, having, you know, I think maybe 10 total, if I had to guess, between all rarities. There's probably, like, 10 gigantic Eldrazi, maybe 12 from the first set. Like, we've already had that many spoiled in this set alone, which is kind of cool. So it is cool to see, like, you know, the types of, like, Void Winnower is not an effect you necessarily are going to see on a 3-mana card. I guess we had a very strange 4-mana enchantment that checked converted mana costs at one point. But that aside, like, it's just not a text box you can really put on something cheap because, A, you don't want it coming up in a ton of games, and B, it's very unique and not something you want to print very often. So when you put it on this 9-drop, all of a sudden it's got reason to exist. It's like, what is a cool thing we could throw on a 9-drop? How about this crazy text about even casting cost spells and even creatures and stuff? Kind of like we saw it on Platinum Imperion is another good example. That's obviously not an Eldrazi, but it's like, you know, you're spending a ton of mana on this guy. We could put some really cool text on there. And so as a result, you have all these really big, expensive, awesome guys, and they all have these really cool text boxes that are really fun to think about. And I think that's pretty healthy for the game to see every once in a while.
Yeah, so I feel like the better deck is going to be, you know, something more complex that's multicolors where you're ingesting and using these potential really high-value cards where if you can take something from exile to their graveyard, you get a pretty powerful effect. But kind of who doesn't want to just ramp up to cast Ulamog again?
Yeah, blue-black definitely gets the best Eldrazi for that, for the ingest purposes. Like, they have
the two in the black, I think, feels like is the best one just because
two in the black guy is very strong. There's also the black flyer that eats things, and whenever you eat something, you draw a card. He doesn't ingest or anything himself, but he is a black Eldrazi that probably goes well in that deck. The flash counterspell guy, the new Mystic Snake, is very strong, I think.
In the dedicated deck, it would be another surprise. Yeah.
So there's some interesting things. Again, because these cards don't necessarily work on their own, it's going to be weird to see how people piece them together. But, you know, things with ingest like that 2-mana 1/1 ingest, you might just see play by default because people really want to play Wasteland Strangler and stuff, and they need ways to exile cards. So,
is that the official name of the black one, Wasteland Strangler?
Wasteland Strangler is the -3.
That's a good one. Okay, that one. Yeah, it's just baller. Okay, I love tribal, so seeing Eldrazi as a tribe to me is very exciting. Maybe because allies already were realized as a tribe before, maybe that's why it's just less interesting to me. Sure. It just feels like this is all new that I'm seeing right now. Unless they give me a Camarids, that'd be the only way I could be more excited.
I don't think you'd be excited by Camarids. All right, what are we doing? Are we done?
I had one. This is just a general Magic question. It's not even about the set or even a card in particular. Now that, and Adam can probably look at this, my kids are getting a little bit older, so it's actually a bit easier to get out and not, you know, feel bad about it, is I've formed a new playgroup. These are actually some, one is a guy that I played with in high school, so we're talking 20 years ago at this point, and they're getting back into Magic. So we're talking, this is OG table Magic, where they have like a random collection of like fifth edition and then some, you know, there's some Time Spiral and blah, blah, blah. And they don't even necessarily hold to the 60 card deck limits. They didn't realize that was a rule. That level of type of Magic room. So I'm starting to play with them, and I would like to introduce them to like some, what I call a four man. So I'm not saying like, hey, we're going to start playing Modern, but I think these are a group of, it's all guys. So these guys, I think, would really enjoy something like Commander, where it's like, hey, I have a pretty limited card pool. So, you know, things like Commander or Highlander works really well because I don't need four of a card. I can just play with one as long as I have one of those. My question for you is, if you have these guys that, you know, really are just used to like putting together a deck and playing, you know, multiplayer Magic, they're not cared if it's Standard, Modern, Legacy, whatever it is. How do you introduce a new format? Like, they had never even heard of Draft before. Like, they bought a booster. This is before I started playing with them. They bought a booster box. They just opened the packs. And it's like, you know, next time we got to do a draft, they're like, what's a draft? So, like, you know, how do you introduce the stuff to... To me, it's fascinating, because that's the way I started playing Magic. So that's why I think it's perfect.
So it's super hard. Like, there's no one right answer, no easy answer for you, Tom.
Yeah, that's why I get your, like, your opinions. Like,
Duels of the Planeswalkers might be the best answer. I'm going to let Adam go on about this because I don't know too well. I'm not a great teacher at this type of thing. But something designed to onboard players to get them into current Magic and like learning kind of like modern day cards and stuff like that might be the easiest transition to get them to play any format. Like, I know Commander is very different than Duels of the Planeswalkers, but just catching them up to like the modern pacing of the game might be a good start. But otherwise, I'm going to defer to Adam here.
Yeah, I mean... Commander is super daunting because, like, just piling up any 100 cards that have sufficient mana sources in there is, like, one way to go. But, like, obviously you really want a synergistic deck. Like, you want a theme, you want the cards that support that theme, and there's a lot of legendary creatures that you want from, like, the past year. Like every set seems to have some legendary creatures in it because of the Commander effect, for lack of a better term for it. Like, it seems like, oh, making something, having a couple legendary creatures that are relevant to the story are great, like, it ties into the flavor, but also, like, it gives you new legendary stuff for the Commander players to look at every set.
Not to me.
The format I would actually suggest that you suggest to them and kind of bring up is multiplayer sealed. And it's something I've had good success with. And I'll walk through the reasons quickly why. So chipping in all collectively to a booster box makes it much more accessible, especially if you order online. You know, for example, like, okay, cool, like,
say if, like, from School Stuff Inc.
Yeah, like you go to Cool Stuff Inc. or eBay or lots of sources. Like, obviously, I prefer Cool Stuff Inc. and I maxed out my customer rewards there, so like I just really don't get better deals elsewhere at this point. You know. Everybody chipping in for like two booster boxes together makes it a much smaller cut. Like, okay, cool. Like, I know I'm getting new cards and I know I'm going to do something with them. And the thing is like when you play sealed, right? It's exactly what they already know how to do. It's like, I'm going to get a pile of random cards. I'm going to figure out and build a deck and then I'm going to play. The reason you do multiplayer is that it gets everybody together. So you don't have to explain draft. You don't have to have like a draft strategy, and there can be a competitiveness to draft because like you're naturally dueling. By doing multiplayer sealed, like you can have a rule like attack left. So like everybody makes a deck, everybody knows what they need to do with it, and by having attack left or attack right, which is one of the rules I like to use, it gives you one opponent effectively. Like, I know I need to beat this person, and I need to keep this other person from beating me. And that type of flow, like it makes the games move along. You get a lot less of the turtling, a lot less of the let's do weird stuff. A great set that's actually super cheap right now and has a bunch of great cards is Conspiracy, which is also one that I would recommend because it's fairly agnostic. It's not going to spike anytime soon because it's not affecting Standard and it's not going to rotate out. It's fairly flat. You know, but the reason I like multiplayer sealed is like everybody feels like they get cards. They get new toys to play with. They open more packs, so they're getting more of the weird rares and the things that you can use in Commander decks. By everybody opening a box at once, for example, I think if you get six people together, you can have, you know, 2-3 player games from one booster box.
So would you do like the usual 6 packs then? Like when you do this?
Yeah, 6 packs sealed or 8 pack or some fair number depending on how you're dividing up. Okay. And then at the end, everybody can especially if everybody chipped in evenly for the money, you can look at the rares and say, okay, what was really valuable out of here, like, you know, rares and foils, and kind of divide it back up, which means just because I don't open a card, like my buddy opens a card that's really that I want to put in a commander deck someday or some other format that we've talked about, or my random multiplayer deck because it has, you know, whirling dervishes, and like this is like going to supercharge them. Like at the end, everybody can have an opportunity to have cards that they want to take away and build with later. And so it's very much like skewing away from competitiveness and more towards everybody kind of collaborating together to have a great night of playing Magic, where then I'm going to get a bunch of staple commons and uncommons from the new set that I can use, plus like a couple rares at the end of it all. And the guy that opens a foil planeswalker, yeah, like he might end up with like a foil planeswalker at the end. But he's not going to get like a whole bunch of the other awesome stuff too. Like you can have everyone chip in and redraft based on how they went out of the game or who did what.
That sounds perfect.
By doing that over time, like you don't necessarily need a lot, but like two or three sets down the road, like a year from now, they're going to have built up like just cards randomly. Like even if somebody doesn't go online and buy singles at all, they're going to build up like enough random cards doing this, you know, a couple weeks out of every set, that they're going to have stuff to build a commander deck with, and they're going to have enough non-basic lands, and everybody's going to end up with a couple of the new dual lands that are in the set, and you end up with this very nice propagation of getting them a basis to build their own decks off of, because that's really the critical tipping point you need to push them towards. Like without cards to build off of, they're going to feel forced to either go buy a bunch online and make some mistakes, or buy boxes and open them themselves. Like, you know, I really like sealed as kind of like the go-to format. If they go to a pre-release, they get exactly what's going on, and there's really no difference for deck construction. If they've just tried the set at a pre-release, coming and playing multiplayer with a sealed deck is going to be different, because like then they feel like it's not the same type of dual experience. I've had a lot of success with that over the years.
I mean, so that's great. I mean, that sounds kind of perfect what I'm thinking for this group, actually. And two, is, you know, it's not that we're playing like three times a week. It's probably going to be like once a month, you know, maybe a couple times a month where, boy, I mean, that means like every third, fourth time we play, you could literally do the new set and do a new, you know, sealed deck. That'd be really cool, actually.
Yep. And somebody you probably want to ping is Bruce Richard, Mana Burned on Twitter.
Oh, Bruce Richards. Yeah, I love that guy.
He's gone through several casual groups and kind of he has a lot of cool suggestions and ideas for formats that work for different card pools and kind of different game skills, because that's also going to be a thing. Is you might end up with like,
I guess it'd be serious fun. Really, that would be his. Yeah,
and they start reading stuff and they figure out what's good and what's not, and then like two other buddies that are just kind of like, oh, cool, Magic stuff. Let's do this tonight. You know, I'll bring some beer. And it's very much like that. They're there for the social engagement, which is kind of where I've typically come from historically with the game. So having ways like sealed that kind of sealed plus multiplayer that kind of mitigate anyone's individual strength with kind of a group dynamic, you know, it doesn't appeal to everyone. But if you're just getting together and having a couple beers and playing some Magic, you know, for one night, like it's usually fine, even for like the more competitive types, because they're going to be able to do their stuff with their deck too.
Okay.
Alternatively, there's $5,000 a game heads up draft.
Yeah, just yeah, straight. Or because I think most of these people have kids, so we could just all throw in, you know, just barter kids. You know, so y'all come out the same
if
number.
You're okay with receiving another person's kids? I guess you.
That's a gamble. I'd say it's probably the biggest gamble you could possibly do. So I know my kids getting a brand new one and be like, oh God, I have. Do you like mac and cheese? Do you like mac and cheese, or do you like chicken nuggets?
It's like the pull-out method.
I like all of them. Coitus interruptus, please use the official term for that one.
Sorry.
I had to learn about that and kind of counsel. It's like, yeah, it just really doesn't work. So you should probably try something else.
I just read an article that claims that it is, when used properly, is as effective as condoms. I don't know how the validity of the
article. I would love to read that article, because that sounds like complete bullshit.
But apparently there was like some studies done, and like people found that if you like actually do it correctly, that the problem is most people don't do it correctly. But I don't. I obviously that's not my method. I'm not endorsing it. I'm just saying.
And that also, and one of the reasons too that when we were kind of counseled about how to teach this is that quiz interruptus does not protect you against sexually transmitted infections, which is a big positive of condoms.
Yes.
But it doesn't protect you against crabs, just so you know. Unless you really put that condom on pretty aggressively.
I mean, the only crabs I have are revenge crabs, Tom. So.
Unless you're using the full body condoms from Naked Gun. I practice safe sex.
All right. I say we skip through land and foil discussion because we talked so much about the set, and we took cover that later. And instead, we moved to a little tournament ditty that is happening this weekend that Adam may or may not be.
Yes, he might have some sort of vested interest in this, or I might be bribing him to throw it so my just elaborate gambling ring will net me a lot of money.
That is, if you're going to gamble, it should be on the Magic Community Cup. Mm-hmm. That's where the big money is.
Yeah, and I'm fixing it. So this is like just classic horse racing.
I mean,
I'm gonna give Adam a whole boatload of Lasix. Get the weight off, then he'll play real fast.
The rest of the community is gonna hate you if we lose now, Tom. You know that, right?
Yeah. It's Tom's fault.
So by the time you see this, the results of the Community Cup will already be in, but it won't be.
So congratulations, Adam.
We don't know. I hope so. I hope it's congratulations to everyone else on my team that carried me, because good Lord, I feel like that's what's gonna happen. So it's the Community Cup. The formats are pretty straightforward. Stipulation draft, Legacy Cube. So basically, it's like things like, are they wearing a cloak?
So,
bears.
Real quickly, I would like to.
Different, you know, Wooburg order picks.
The stipulation draft was insanely different. So, I was basically the only pro on my Community Cup team. I had Jackie Lee helping me, who was up and coming at the time, but not really like to the same, quite at the same level. But the stipulation draft, the things, like some of them were like, you can only draft even converted mana costs. If there's a land in the pack, you have to take it over any other card. So, like, if there's
a bunch of weird rules that you have to follow.
Yeah, you get a weird rule, and you as a drafter have to follow that rule. Each player has a different rule, and the thing is, it's Magic Online.
Do you know the other person's rules, or is that a mystery that you
know? No, everyone knows everyone's rules. You actually draft them. You draft, so you barter points and whatnot, and you go up and at the board and you choose a rule that you think you can actually achieve. They're all pretty tough, but like the person who gets the last rule is always the hardest. It's like the land rule was one of the ones, because every time a land was in the pack, you were required to take it. So at the end you had like 10 spells in your total in your deck. Like you were hoping to receive packs that had no lands, so you could actually choose a card. So like there's some really, really tough ones. You have to figure it out ahead of time and come up with a strategy and be like, this person likes aggro and we think this rule is going to be aggro or whatever. But anyway, as the draft's going on, it's Magic Online. So there's like monitors next to each other. So what we did is we figured out the order. The monitors not happen in order. It's not like this person's passing this person, passing this person. This person's passing the person over down that corner who's passing to this person. So what we did is like mapped out every order of the draft was going for the eight people. And then I ran around to every single person's chair as it was their pick and like explained what the best strategy was. Not because that person couldn't figure out what they needed for themselves, but because it would influence who the next person was. So like,
is that not cheating?
No, it's not cheating. You're encouraged to help each other. It's a community thing. So the rules are like, so like one person has the rule where they have to take a rare if it's in the pack, and it's cube. At least for us, it was cube. So it was like, if there's a rare in the pack, you have to take it. You're not allowed to take an uncommon or a common over a rare. So this one person, you know, he has this rule, and breeding pool's in the pack, but no other lands are in the pack. And I know that two seats down, the land person's coming up. And if this person on our team takes Breeding Pool, the land person gets to take an important spell for their deck early on and then help, and that helps their deck or whatever. So, like, literally you're trying to, like, to run every single deck and every single rule into another deck.
It's like a weird scavenger hunt.
I never sat down. I would run over to my thing, highlight a pick, not selected, but just highlight it to where it would auto pick, then run around to every single other computer and just like, all right, this person has to take a creature with power two. So if you take this, then they could take the Stoneforge Mystic randomly. And then I'm like, this person has an Elspeth in their deck, so they really need the Glorious Anthem. And like, it was insane for me. It was one of the most fun, like, very stressful at the same time, because I mean, stressful to a degree. It's not like we lose, the end of the world's happening or something, but it was stressful in terms of like figuring everything out, but it was also in terms of like a puzzle and like a challenging thing for a smart person to encounter. It was one of, because everyone else is also smart, they just have different areas that they're better at the game for, like either your podcasters there, you have artists there, you have people who are not necessarily known for like strategy wise. So like, it's kind of on me to help out with that strategy in that particular area, and then other people are going to bring their skill sets in for other games. But it was so chaotic. It was the most fun thing ever. I almost no other format even mattered, because after that format, I like had a blast. I think we got crushed probably. I don't even remember what the specific thing was, but it was so much fun. So hopefully you have an awesome time. I don't know what the rules are this year. They didn't post them yet, right?
No, we don't know what the stipulations are.
Sure.
There's also Iron Root Chef. We don't know what the ingredients are for that yet.
Makes sense.
And it's super awkward, because like everybody is like I was like MTGO Doc, like I jumped on just checked out a stream late last night, and he was like, "Oh, you know, Stibbs is like going to be like the clutch for the Iron Root Chef draft." And the secret is like Iron Root Chef is just totally subjective, right? Like either like Nate like and the judging like agrees with like, cool, like I totally see what the flavor that you're going with there, or like you think you have this flavorful thing, and Nate is just like, nope, that's not flavorful at all, and you just get like hosed. So it's just like this really weird thing where like I think I have an idea, and like sometimes Nate and I agree, a lot of times we don't necessarily. And so like it's gonna be like that's like definitely like the swingiest one, because you can have the worst deck but still earn generally the most points. And again, I haven't seen the rules for like this year, but like that's typically how it's gone. Is like you might have a super flavorful deck that just like cannot win a game, but you end up like bringing in more points than the person that won every single game with their deck.
Sounds like
because,
I might
like,
be able
they,
to do that.
They felt it was unflavorful. Yeah. So like, there's this tension of like, how do you appeal to the judge and judging and make that work? And then there's two different Battle for Zendikar drafts. There's going to be one that's on Magic Online, and then I guess one in paper. Which is going to be like super weird. Like, I guess they got a booster box.
Maybe they'll like, maybe they'll just print out like screenshots of MTGO, and that'll be the cards.
That's what it's going to be.
Yeah,
called up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it should be a lot of fun. I hope we're successful and everybody's not like.
I mean, every community
posting in the comments like, "Thanks for taking my Nielsen basics from you, Magic Online jerk." Like, I'm waiting for that to happen because like.
You're basically guaranteed to succeed because, to my knowledge, every single community team ever has won.
No, one team lost.
I don't know about that.
I'm pretty sure it was the John Locke's year.
I'm trying to remember if John Locke's was on my team.
Congratulations!
I remember winning that year. I don't recall ever losing. So we're just gonna move on to a new topic.
I think we're pretty much at the end. I think Adam, did you have like some sort of special story?
I guess he did go over the formula. We lost, Adam. We lost. I'm being sarcastic. It was me on my team. We lost. John lost. So.
Yeah.
Yes, you did.
Yes.
So let's not have the double losers here. Also, I just realized our shirts match, which is kind of adorable. Yeah.
Except Conley's wearing a flesh hair colored undershirt as opposed to a black black t-shirt over there.
As I told Luis today, we all celebrate weight loss in our own way.
So that seductive dressing, I guess. I'm not sure what the.
No,
I'm waiting for you to the next podcast. There just being this enormous chest tattoo. There, just big, where I can see it. It's like Eldrazi.
I have been considering getting a tattoo. I have zero tattoos on my body, but I've been considering getting one.
The one I want to get, I'm not allowed. I was.
You're not by your wife?
Yeah, I was told you cannot get that tattoo. Like,
what, is it Rosie O'Donnell on the calf?
No, that would be another one. But no, it's the Star Trek Communicator badge on the chest. I was told.
Oh.
I highly recommend you don't get that tattoo.
That is nice. I like
but
it.
Why would she no-cert it? That's a...
Just straight no-cert.
Mm-hmm. Or I may have just said, or the other one is I'll just tattoo my entire chest red and that can always be the red shirt guy.
I think I would.
I would no-cert that one personally.
Yeah.
I don't think I could stand the pain of having like a large portion of my body tattooed.
All right, so this cast has gone on long enough. I think it's time to wrap. I think it's fair, and I promise the story.
Wait, to wrap or to pull out?
To wrap it up,
to
maybe?
And to finish, as in...
Pull out and finish done. Over the... Finish
I was
over
just trying to bring it back around, you know? All right, so Adam
Adam's trying to figure out how to get away from the
I'm gonna
pull
have
it
to,
out
I'm have to say for this. Adam has claimed that he has a Tom story that he's going to tell.
Yeah, that's what I want to hear.
In case anyone is trying to figure out what a Tom story is, it basically has no rules or limits to it. It could be anything. So I'm prepared to – I have a vomit bag.
Yep.
Get your vomit bags ready. And if you have an imagination that's very visual-based and you need to see what's being described, turn your mind off. Just shut your brain down. Just tune back in and like bring
it. Purulent is already in my mind. I'm waiting for
so
those boils.
Yes. Haven't shared this story online anywhere. I couldn't figure out the best way to execute it, so I just decided to let it go. But I found the right execution.
You didn't kill somebody,
did you? Free exclusive story.
Did you eat a human?
Yeah. So it begins this morning. I come downstairs to my office here, my beautiful office, and I need to use the restroom. I'm like, very typical kind of everyday mundane experience.
Did you shit in a deck card box? Tell me you crapped into a card box.
No, I actually use toilets, Tom.
Okay.
For you to leave, but I use them. So I go sit down on the toilet. and I just start doing my business, and it's pretty hefty, and I begin to feel a tickle at my butt crack, a little tickle, a little buzz, not quite sure what it is.
I am right.
No, this is like up in the skin, like at the tip of the cheeks. Again, a worm. Don't imagine this. There's nothing good coming from it if you are right now, and you
I've
are.
Seen enough rectums. I'm pretty sure yours has no surprises left for me. So
I'm trying to figure out what animal is in your toilet or whatever. And that's like
I would right. assume a bee.
So you ever feel like an itch or a scratch or whatever? Like I just kind of ignore it because it's like whatever,
And then it's the wind.
Well, usually I scratch it unless it's my butthole. Yes, I usually would refrain from.
What's going on here? So that's happening, and eventually, like it doesn't go away; it just kind of keeps on going. And I'm like,
they start talking to me.
This is unpleasant. Like I feel like maybe there really is like a bug or something. So as soon as I finish, I stand up and I wipe myself, and then I feel like the little bug skitter thing like on my butt cheek. So I'm like, oh, that's super awkward. There was a bug. And so I, brush off and look to the floor next to me. And it's a little tiny brown recluse. But like yay. Which is I'm pretty sure still big enough to bite me. So I'm kind of on like ass crack brown recluse watch right now. Trying to figure out if I'm gonna get necrosis of the ass. Crack.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'm at right now.
If you lost a rectum, that is
my life.
The sphincter is pretty important.
Maybe he was just misidentified as the brown rectum, and he thought that was where he needed to be.
He kept trying to get into his house. He's just like something died in here.
Yeah,
I'm surprised that he didn't bite you when you. I mean, like maybe he did. I guess we don't know. You could just lose your butt at any time.
Right, and so that's what I'm kind of like. It's like it's that mental thing where it's like. Well, I feel a little thing there. Was I really, was I bit? Or am I just imagining that I could have been bit, and therefore I feel like, I'm hyper-noticing, any sort of, sensation at the tip of my butt crack.
I've been the exact same way. So I mentioned before the cast that I tore some calf muscles, and one of the complications that can happen, I read about, and I'm sure it doesn't happen very often, but apparently you can get, if the contusion or the whatever is too severe, you can get bone growth that happens in the muscle.
Yeah, it gets ossified.
Yeah, which is like, and so like every time I'm like doing my massages or physical therapy or whatever, and I like feel a little any like nodule or like tension or whatever, I'm like, is that a bone? What the hell is going on? And like
it takes a long time.
Yeah, it would obviously take a very long time, and there's like basically no chance. But one of the things they said was if you do have ossification, is that how you say ossification? Then
ossification.
You're supposed to stop massaging because apparently it can. Make that process quicker or whatever. So like while I'm massaging, like it doesn't even matter. I'm pretty sure there's no bone being grown in my muscle, but it still is like you read about it one time and every single time you go down there, you're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So if a brown recluse was anywhere near my butt for like the next 48 hours, I would just be like in a mirror staring at my shoulder.
You rigged up some sort of system so you can constantly monitor your own.
Yeah. Smartphone attached to a stick.
That'd probably be the best use for a selfie stick would be to be able to monitor my own butt.
Check my ass crack.
Mm-hmm. Brown recluse stick.
So that's MTG Potpourri, everyone. That is 65% magic, 45%.
Somehow, while that was a Tom story, it was much classier than most Tom stories, simply in execution, so I'll give you kudos for that.
Thank you.
Content was Tom, execution was classier.
Yeah.
Well, how are my stories less classy? I'm just curious now.
It's more about like the meanderingness. Like
he wasn't trapping spiders with women.
You have a story, you have a goal to get to, but like you have tangents from this. Like you're already on a tangent, and then you keep taking extra tangents. I think what it is like we'd like to see a little focus. Like when you have like a story that you want to hit that point where like people are disgusted, like. Narrow, hit that point. Like,
just get right to the bush where like you get grossed out. Like when I'm seeing a patient with a CPAP machine. That's not working very well, and you realize the reason it's not working well is because they've been masturbating with it, and their filter is clogged with semen.
So you already got there. We're already at the end of the story.
Yeah.
It's the shortest Tom story ever. Mm-hmm.
That is a phenomenal execution. It's like that non sequitur into completely, why did I imagine what was going on?
Also, thanks, now Tom. All I can think about is somebody masturbating with a... Mm-hmm.
I would recommend like a bi-level machine, because you're going to get much higher pressures, and you also get sort of an in-and-out sort of potentially a sucking motion, which might not having used it.
You were able to educate us on.
Yeah, so if you want to adjust your bi-level settings for maximal and potential enjoyment with masturbation, email us at mtgpopery@gatheringmagic.com. Got there for the email address.
We just went from Matt. All right.
Whatever. You want to turn off the ramp.
I'm on Twitter.
You don't want to start on low. Well, actually, no, maybe you do want to start low to kind of.
All right. If you would like any non-masturbation discussion, you can feel free to message me on Twitter at Conley81. If you have any masturbatory related content, please send it towards either the MTG Potpourri main tweet site or to Tom directly at PSG Reader. Do not send it to anybody else. Thank you.
At CPAP Bowl.
Also, TCGPlayer.com. I have my Battle for Zendikar. We're doing it a little differently this time. I will not be doing limited reviews. It's going to be I'm changing it and I'm conlifying the review. So the review is going to be all constructor related, and there's going to be a bunch of like deck ideas and combo ideas and like synergy for each card, and basically going to discuss like things you could do with the cards that are fun and more Conley-esque. So it's going to be, rather than just the review being basically a set of numbers, you can go to almost any website and find somebody's take on numbers, it's going to be kind of more tailored to
more of like a brewing, I guess, approach to a set.
Exactly. Okay. Kind of a brewer's take on the set. So
that's probably more interesting to a lot of people.
Like this, so it'll be, I'm sure there'll be some rough spots or whatever I have to figure out, but at the same time, it should be interesting. That's all I got.
Yep. Adam, what about you? You write stuff.
I do. I'm Adam Sporsky. I write lots of stuff. I write the Thursday Commander Tower.
I write lots of apologies.
Commander Column Command Tower on MagicGathering.com. I do a bunch of stuff on Gathering Magic. I'm going to be updating my Popper Cube for Battle for Zendikar. Oh my god, spell lands and good stuff. So if you like Cube, read mine. It's okay. I'm also on Twitter, at @the_Stibs, STYBS. You can talk to me about all sorts of things that you would not talk to a medical professional about. That would be my strong recommendation. I am not a medical professional. I cannot give you medical advice. I'm like Tom.
But you are an expert about observing your own. But if you have questions about how to best observe your own butt crack and potentially butthole.
Wait, why did we have, you didn't have to add the extra part. We knew that like that's attached to the crack. It's part of
this. Yeah, but Adam in his story described that he clearly was observing both parts of this. So he had experience with that.
I'm just going to reiterate, if you have what you feel is a serious butt problem, dermatological, rectal,
go to the buttologist,
anything like that,
please
seek help from a medical professional.
The only exception is if you have baby powder questions.
That was the first time I think you truly surprised me, was that whole baby powder. That still is weird. Do you still use baby powder? Are you still
I do not. Well, I'm no longer fat, so I do not need it nearly as much. It was a problem for me when I was really out of shape and visiting a lot of places that had a lot of humidity. I live in Denver, which is extremely dry. It's a desert. And I've lost a lot of weight, so the need for baby powder has gone down significantly. Although, I do things like put Band-Aids on my
nipple. I thought the dancing, you'd just be – I thought you'd want, like, more baby powder.
No, I get no – I get no rashes or anything. The only thing I get is what my shirt sweats and then it rubs on my nipples, so I get nipple rashes. So I have to wear Band-Aids on my nipples.
You're like a marathoner.
Yeah, so I switched. I've changed it up.
No, I bought special underpants when I climbed Kilimanjaro because it's jungle at the bottom and basically winter on top. It was like the special wicking material, but it was like underpants made out of that. Do you have like wicking underpants?
No, I probably should get some. I basically just use my. I've actually started wearing boxer briefs while dancing, but when I was just using my boxers, they were kind of not the best. They ride up and stuff.
But it would just be. I mean, stuff moves around and it kind of feels weird.
Yeah, but I focused primarily on footwear thus far just because it's been very hard for me to figure out the style of footwear I need. So that's been my primary focus. I've gotten pretty good.
What about the shoes where all your toes are like in their own little holes?
No. I would break every toe in my body. Would not be fun.
Then you can encase that in steel.
All right. I'm going to stop talking now so that way the cast can end.
Okay. I'm still thinking about Adam's butt crack story. I'm just fascinated by that one.
This has been MTG Potpourri, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do with the toilet after that? Did you spray that? Did you like fumigate your entire basement?
No, I just picked up the seat, confirmed there were no
additional spiders. I said, hey, this is the kids' toilets now. I'm not using this one ever again. Put the toilet seat on.
You're a terrible father. This podcast is over. Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.